Welcome to the Political Cesspool, known worldwide as the South's foremost populist radio program. And here to guide you through the murky waters of the political cesspool is your host, James Edwards.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Political Cesspool radio program. We are now into our second hour of tonight's live broadcast. You are listening to us on AM 1380 WLRM Radio in Memphis, Tennessee, our flagship station. Also going out to our newest affiliate station, also here in Memphis, AM 1600 WNMQM. And to all the AM-FM affiliate stations across the country of the Liberty News Radio Network. Simulcasting online as well, thepoliticalcesspool.org. That's our official website, thepoliticalcesspool.org, and libertynewsradio.com. I want to thank Keith Alexander this Saturday evening, May 21st, for his excellent contributions to tonight's broadcast. The first hour with Keith Alexander is always a highlight for me and for our listening audience as well, I'm sure. I want to take a quick call. This lady has been very patient to get on the show. Trisha from right here in Memphis. Trisha, you're on the line.
Yes, I'm on the line. How are you, James? How are
doing,
you, Keith?
Doing good. Doing good. How are you?
I am fine.
Well, what can I do for you?
I wanted to make a comment on what Keith was saying about Booker T. Washington,
right,
and what Obama mentioned about the kids not having any support or anything given to them.
Right.
And that may have a lot of truth to what Keith has said. I do see what he's saying about the state assistance. And probably, I want to say probably 95% of those kids do receive some type of state subsidy. However, when it comes to graduation, I typically write about this particular thing. When it comes to graduation, even if those students had a 4.0 grade point average and they did not pass the state-mandated test, they would not graduate. And that is a direct effort of the students. And I was curious myself, wondering, you know, if teachers are teaching to a test, are they actually teaching the kids anything? And what I found out is, yes, the kids are being taught something. It's just that the objectives, the standards that Tennessee has had in the past have been pretty low standards. And so they're being pushed and moved to national standards, in which the kids will be more globally competitive. And, you know, and another thing, I did find that, yes, because of the high minority rate here in Memphis, Tennessee, that there is a large percentage of minorities on state assistance funds. However, in the country as a whole, most of the people that receive food stamps and state assistance are white. And this is the one last point that I wanted to make. Let's say that we pull all the help from the students that are at Booker T. Washington and schools like us, and then we don't have a good graduation rate. And I agree with him about how the Memphis City Schools as a whole does not run their funds well. I totally agree with that. However, 85% of the people in prison do not have a high school diploma. They haven't graduated from high school. So with that being said, that means that when we look at these students that have graduated from Booker T. Washington, that means that is that much less of a chance that somebody's going to be breaking down your door at night, a less chance that somebody's going to be carjacking us. So really, there are some positives. And what I see is how much more effort can we put in so more of them can graduate, to lessen the chance of them being criminals and become productive citizens.
Hey, listen, you brought up a lot of very objective points, and I want to appreciate you for doing so. I want to appreciate you for calling in tonight, and thanks for listening. I hope to hear from you again. And I'd like
okay.
to now take the opportunity.
Thank you. God bless you. Bye-bye.
Yeah, thank you, Trisha. Yeah, God bless you. She brings up some good points. She really does. And I want to say this before I respond to some of the points she made, and that is, and we said it at the first, you know, we're not taking anything out on these kids. I said it at the top of the hour, last hour, that I want and I hope, I don't think this will probably be the case, but I want everybody that graduated from Booker T. Washington last week, I want everybody that was there in attendance at Obama's speech to be productive and contributing members of society. I want them to be good citizens. I don't think that'll happen, but that's my wish. Why would I want anything else? She brought up the point, yeah, you know, I do think that teachers in these public schools are instructing in such a way that the students will be able to pass a test, not necessarily learn a lot, and there's a difference. And also, yeah, you do have to pass a test in order to graduate. There's no doubt about that, and they are doing that. But my problem is, I think that the standards have certainly fallen very drastically from, say, the 1950s and 60s. You look at public education, public schools in the 1950s and 60s. If you graduated from a public school in 1950, you had the equivalent of a master's degree in today's educational field. And that, of course, isn't the case anymore. And so standards in public education have certainly dropped. She brought up another point that there are more whites on welfare than there are blacks. Well, that's probably true in terms of sheer numbers, but definitely not in relation to their percentage of the population. Here in Tennessee, you know, the state of Tennessee is still overwhelmingly white. Now, Memphis is 60% plus black, the city itself, but overall, it doesn't surprise me that there would be more whites on welfare in Tennessee as far as the number goes, but when compared and contrasted their percentage of the population, you know, it's just, you know, blown away. Blacks are going to be on welfare at a higher clip than whites. She also gets into the role that poverty and lack of education play in terms of crime. These are certainly factors that play into it. I still believe that genetic predisposition plays a bigger role in a person's outcome than his economic circumstance. Certainly, you know, the better education you have, the better off you're going to be in life. There's no doubt about that. And they all go in together. But, you know, she brings up, that actually leads me into another story. We've got a lot to cover. And I do want to thank Tricia for that call. That was a very, very good call. She brings me up to another story, though, that I wanted to get into. And this hour, ladies and gentlemen, is going to be chock full of quick stories, short stories. And we're going to start, I guess, right after this next commercial break, because we only have a minute left. But when we come back, we're going to talk about the question, and I'm not so sure that Tricia was raising this question, but a lot of people do. Does poverty cause crime, or is poverty one of the biggest factors in the upbringing of a criminal? We're going to give one example that may prove that is certainly not the case, and it happened right there in Detroit, and Memphis is fast on its way to becoming the next Detroit, unfortunately. Also this hour, you're going to hear us talk about how baggy pants, this is another story that actually took place right here in Memphis, baggy pants helped police catch a rape suspect. We're going to be talking about a woman who was kicked off the train for talking too loud. Hate crimes charges have been issued in the beating of that Maryland transvestite at a McDonald's, so we're going to be talking about that. Glenn Beck and Rachel Maddow are at it again. Black fella stole a computer from a Walmart, then he stole a police car. All of this stuff, by the way, is at our website, thepoliticalcesspool.org. We're going to be getting into all those stories and more. We're going to cover so much news this hour, your head's going to spin. We're going to do it right after this.
There's more Political Cesspool coming your way right after these messages.
When the truth is found to be...
Welcome back. To get on the Political Cesspool, call us on James's Dime, toll-free, at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the Political Cesspool, James Edwards.
All right, welcome back to the show, everybody. Reverend Ted Pike, the National Director of the National Prayer Network at truthtellers.org, our good friend Ted Pike, will be back with us for the third and final hour a little bit later on tonight. But first, we've got a lot of stories to cover this hour. And you know, a lot of liberals will always say that poverty is the biggest determinant in whether or not someone grows up to be a criminal. We say that genetic predisposition is. And it's not, yeah, you could say race, but it's not, and they laugh that off as saying, well, you know, the color of a person's skin. You say the color of a person's skin or their skin pigmentation determines whether or not they are more likely to grow up to be criminals or whether or not they're more likely to have lower IQs. It has nothing to do with something as trivial as the color of their skin, as liberals like to laugh off that argument and make it sound foolish. It has everything to do, though, with the most important things, and that's your very DNA, your genetic makeup, your genetic, you're genetically predisposed to certain behavioral traits. I absolutely believe that. Anyway, poverty causes crime. No, it doesn't. And, you know, you can grow up poor. My grandparents grew up poor in Mississippi and never once, committed a crime. And why isn't Detroit ever going to come back? Well, this is something we wrote about on the blog. One story that debunks the whole poverty causes crime argument. Here it is. Greg McNichol was a 45-year-old naturalized citizen from Australia. He was living in California when he fell in love with Detroit after visiting the area. What was wrong with that guy? The misguided McNichol suddenly felt the need to take up the white man's burden and be part of the coming renaissance of Detroit. So he moved from California and bought a run-down 10-unit apartment complex in one of the worst parts of Detroit. He moved himself in, taking the worst apartment, and worked constantly to improve the place. Until the other day, that is. Detroit ain't ever going to have a renaissance, and for McNichol, the point is moot anyway, because he's dead. Shot to death, cops say, by Freddie Young, a man who 3 months ago cleared $1.5 million after winning the lottery. But Young didn't appreciate the fact that McNichol was evicting his 20-year-old black daughter for not paying the rent. But instead of taking some of his $1.5 million and helping his daughter out, he chose to kill the honky. When millionaires go around shooting the very people who are attempting to bring Detroit back, it's obvious that poverty is not the cause of crime and that Detroit ain't ever coming back. So, to pare it down, and that was a article that we posted to our website this week, you got this guy, this 45-year-old liberal from Australia. He moved to California at some point, visited Detroit, and thought, man, I love it here. I love the slums. I love the ghetto. I love diversity. I'm going to move here and help them bring their town back. Well, he buys this rundown apartment building, puts himself in the worst of the worst units, and he starts renting it out to people. He rents it out to this black woman who doesn't pay rent, so he evicts her, and then he gets killed by her father, who had just won $1.5 million a few days earlier. You know, poverty causes crime. Speaking of crime, hate crimes charges are coming up in Maryland. We all remember that vicious, brutal beating that was visited upon that white victim at the McDonald's in Maryland. Now, the two black women who administered their form of jungle justice upon the victim have been charged with hate crimes, and white people should be furious. The story reads that two teens are facing hate crimes charges in the beating of a transgendered woman at a McDonald's, an attack that was caught on video and posted online. Now, why am I saying that white people should be furious over the fact that these two black teenagers are getting hate crimes charges in response to the beating that they put on this white person? You see, and you'll remember, and we posted this story and talked about it on the radio a couple of weeks ago, when the video of this incident first went viral, it was no big deal, hardly worth any ink or airtime from the mainstream media. After all, it was just a white girl being given her due for being a racist, for 400 years of slavery, for Jim Crow, for what happened to Jonathan Perkins, etc., etc. Beatings like that happen all the time, and they should happen more because white people are racist. That's pretty much the message we get from every mainstream media outlet besides this show. Two black girls beat a white girl into a seizure. You know, that's almost something that would put us to sleep. No big deal at all. But wait, there's more. The white girl that was beaten turned out to really be a guy. Chrissy Lee Polis is a transvestite. And pervert is the new black. This means that blacks can get away with murder when it involves white people unless that white person is a homosexual or a transvestite or a so-called transgendered person. And that is why white people should be very mad about this incident. What we are learning is that the only way for white people to get justice in this pandemic of black-on-white violence is for white people to be, as I say, a homosexual or a transvestite. Talk about choosing between the lesser of two evils. An interesting subplot to this story is that one of the black girls was upset that her boyfriend was talking to, quote-unquote, Chrissy. Black girls don't like it when black guys pursue white girls. Now, isn't there a word for people who think that people should date and marry within their own race? Well, that word only applies when it's white people that think that way, of course. Since we're on the topic of crime and poverty and black crime and, you know, things of that nature, you got to check out the article that I posted to our website on May 18th. It's entitled Black Woman Kicked Off Train for Talking Too Loud, and it happened up in Oregon, of all places. The video doesn't have sound. It's actually raw footage that was shot from the local television affiliate there, but you'll see everything you need to see and more at the 25-second mark. The woman was nearly too obese to even, I don't even see how she fit in inside the door of the train, but nevertheless, it's all up there on video. ThePoliticalCesspool.org, ThePoliticalCesspool.org. Here's the scoop. A woman who got pulled off an Amtrak train by police after passengers complained that she was speaking too loudly on a cell phone said she felt disrespected by the entire incident. Lakeisha Beard of Tigard, Oregon, was charged with disorderly conduct after police said she got into a verbal altercation with train passengers last Sunday. Passengers complained that she refused to put down her cell phone, and conductors had to stop the train in Salem, Oregon, where police got involved. An Amtrak official said a number of passengers complained Beard was being disrespectful during her prolonged phone conversations on the train. Salem police reported that she had been on the phone nonstop since the train pulled out of Oakland, California, 16 hours earlier. Amtrak does have a policy that riders can't use cell phones in designated quiet cars like the one this black woman was riding in. So you got a black woman who gets on a train, gets into a quiet car where you're not supposed to talk on the phone, and then she talks obnoxiously loud for 16 straight hours until the people were complaining. And, of course, that was racist, I guess, for them to complain. But nevertheless, it led into a verbal altercation, and the conductor had to stop the train. Police got this woman out. So I say to that, you know, a non-white talking too loudly on a cell phone, thank God Alexandra Wallace wasn't on board this train. We all remember Alexandra Wallace, the former UCLA student who was mercilessly tormented for expressing harmless thoughts about Asians at her school in a YouTube video. I'm going to leave it right there, and I'm going to come back and wrap up my thoughts on this story before we get into much, much more this hour. Stay tuned, everybody.
Don't go away. The Political Cesspool guys will be back right after these messages. Get on the show and express your opinion in the Political Cesspool. Call us toll-free at 1-866-986-6397.
All right, talking to you before that last break about the black woman who was talking for 16 straight hours, obnoxiously loud, in a quiet car of a train, until the conductor finally had to stop the train and she'd be removed by police. Now, that reminded me of a similar incident during which Alexandra Wallace, an 19-year-old student at UCLA, was mercilessly tormented for expressing her thoughts about Asians who were talking too loud on their cell phones in her school library. Now, you'll remember that at the end of the day, this young lady was drummed out of school. She was butchered by the, you know, national media. I mean, this was the biggest news story in America for a couple of days, and they were painting her as the modern-day incarnation of a racist because she was trying to study, and they were talking loud in the library. So it doesn't really have anything to do with the woman on the Amtrak train. I just use that as a segue into it because, you know, once again, you find the media double standard. This was a national news story. This young college co-ed complaining harmlessly and in good nature, I might add, about Asians talking loud on the in the library on her YouTube page. And that becomes a global news story. You know, everybody was lamenting how, you know, racist this young girl was. In the meantime, compare and contrast that to the story we broke to you last week about how the black law student, Jonathan Perkins at the University of Virginia, he completely fabricated, made up by his own admission after an investigation proceeded. They completely admitted to making up the fact that he was, or what wasn't a fact, of course, that he was accosted by two white cops, you know, at his school. And once he said, whoops, you know, just kidding, guys, there was no story. There was no punishment. And this is something that you're talking about, a racially charged matter. This was beginning to get a lot of press. When he made up this lie, this race hoax, it was a big story. And then after it came out that he was lying, he wasn't punished. And the media just forgot about it. Now, once again, you compare and contrast Alexandra Wallace, you know, kind of gets on, gives a good-natured ribbing to Asians on her YouTube, and she is tortured. This black kid at the University of Virginia filed a false police report, cast suspicion and resentment upon every white police officer, subjected every white university police officer to possible violence, and wasted thousands and thousands of dollars in an investigation, and he goes on to graduate. It's not a big deal. And since we're on the topic of black crime and pettiness, here's a good one. This was a new one for me, but it took place right here in Memphis, so I'm not surprised. A 22-year-old man, the story reads, accused of rape, had difficulty escaping from Memphis police officers in Whitehaven, which, ironically enough, is an all-black part of town, because his pants kept falling down around his knees, according to a court affidavit. Police last week arrested Richard Graham of Memphis after a chase through apartment complexes that began in the 3500 block of Longbow near Mill Branch in Winchester. If any of my local listeners, like Trisha, who called in earlier this hour, they'll be familiar with Winchester and the Mill Branch area, and you don't want to go out there without a bulletproof vest. But anyway, the story continues. Loud talking originally drew the officer's attention to three men, including Graham. When police discovered that Graham, who obviously was black, was wanted on a rape charge, he bolted. But he fell, quote, multiple times while running due to the fact that his pants were around his knees, officer wrote in the court document. On March 1st, Memphis police charged Graham with rape following a report of sexual assault last October involving a 14-year-old girl. Police also charged Graham with evading arrest, resisting arrest, and disorderly conduct. He was held in a Shelby County jail with no bond amount immediately set on the rape charge. So, bottom line, you've seen how these folks do. They wear their pants. You know, the belt does no good because they're down around their knees, and they've got underwear that stretches a mile long, and this is how they wear them. You know, this is how they keep it real. And it actually caught up to this fella. He couldn't outrun the cops because his pants were too saggy, and they kept tripping him up. More black crime. You really are never at a shortage for content if this is your subject, but some black crime is more interesting than other. If you go to my website for no other reason this week, you need to go to thepoliticalcesspool.org to see this video that we added. It details a story about a black man who stole a computer from Walmart, and then he went on to steal a police car. And as I wrote, there is just simply never a dull moment in a multiracial society. Here's the story from Somerville, South Carolina. A dashboard camera recorded an unusual altercation between police and a South Carolina man who got into a fight at a stop, then promptly stole the police cruiser and drove off at a high speed before crashing into a garbage truck. According to police, Arthur Thompson, 38 years old, was pulled over after an alert was posted for his green Jeep following a robbery attempt at a local Walmart last Friday. Thompson allegedly attempted to steal a computer and, when confronted, punched a store employee in the mouth. As seen in the dashboard cam video released by police and posted online at the CBS affiliate in Somerville, South Carolina, Thompson exited his Jeep when he was stopped, disobeyed the officer's command, and then attacked the policeman. According to the incident report, the officer used his taser on the suspect twice. First when Thompson started fighting him, and again as he first got into the police cruiser. Thompson nevertheless pulled out the taser barbs and continued fighting. He then drove off in the stolen car at speeds of over 100 miles per hour. The dashboard cam shows Thompson weaving in and out of traffic, running through several red lights, and making erratic maneuvers. The high-speed chase ended 3 miles away when Thompson crashed the cruiser into a truck. Thompson struggled to escape, shattering the window to get out of the wrecked car, but was arrested. I tell you, this guy wasn't going down easy. The victim of the landscaping truck was taken to a hospital and treated for non-serious injuries. Thompson was transported to Medical University of South Carolina for treatment. Thank God he's going to get free treatment. The local TV affiliate there reported that the toxicology test showed Thompson was positive for cocaine. But the incident didn't end there. While at the hospital, are y'all following me, ladies and gentlemen? While at the hospital, Thompson, the black suspect, became extremely violent there, trying to escape his restraints. And during booking, boasted that the size of the policeman he had taken on was 280 pounds. You should have seen how big the officer was that I worked, quote unquote. According to the police report, at the hospital, Thompson admitted that he was high and asked if he made the news. There is so much to that story, it's hard to even give a recap. So you got this black guy in South Carolina. He tries to steal a computer at Walmart. Punches a store employee in the face. He then gets pulled over close to the store. Starts fighting the police officers. Gets struck with a taser twice, but it doesn't faze him because he's on cocaine. He then manages to out-wrestle the cops, gets in the police car, goes on a three-mile journey at speeds of over 100 miles an hour before crashing into a garbage truck. That doesn't even faze him because he's trying to kick out the window and start running around on foot before the officers are able to subdue him. Then once he gets to the hospital, he starts fighting with people there before finally calming down to boast that the officer that he had beaten up was 300 pounds and was wondering if he made the news. You know, just think. If we weren't able to enjoy the fruits of diversity, our lives would never be enriched by experiences like this. They certainly wouldn't be nearly as interesting. But everything that I just mentioned to you, we have on video. We have the video of the dashboard camera from the police car, and it is worth a look. It is worth a look. You can watch the whole ordeal for yourself by visiting thepoliticalcesspool.org. Go to the May 20th article entitled Black Man Steals from Walmart, Then Steals Police Car. It's all there. The story, the links, and the video. Right there at our official website, thepoliticalcesspool.org. We'll be back with more right after this.
Don't go away. The Political Cesspool guys will be back right after these messages.
We'll return. We'll return. We'll return.
Jump in the political cesspool with James and the gang. Call us tonight at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
All right, the hour goes by fast when you got a lot of news to cover, and we've certainly had that, too much to cover tonight. In the second hour of the Political Cesspool Radio program, I have a lot more that I want to get to you than I'm going to have time to do, but I want to give you an update on what Glenn Beck and Rachel Maddow are up to. I'm sure everybody was just dying to hear. But last year I penned, as you may remember, a magnum opus about Glenn Beck's Restoring Honor monstrosity, which was nothing more than a, you know, Michael King love fest where 100,000 white men rooted for their own demise. I may be known as a talk radio host, but I do have enough writing prowess to string together a few lines on rare occasion, and my story detailing that shameful event was widely praised. You can revisit it by going to thepoliticalcesspool.org and clicking on the link entitled Glenn Beck and Rachel Maddow Are At It Again. Because they are at it again. This time, get this, this time Glenn Beck is going to Israel to serve as the ringmaster for a new rally called Restoring Courage. Now, God only knows what kind of craziness Beck has in store for this sequel, but it looks like, from reading the story, he's going to attempt to pander to the Jews as well as he did the blacks during the first incarnation. Now, I don't know how Rachel Maddow fits into this, but for some reason, she's upset. Here's the story. In a sequel to his Restoring Honor rally that took place in Washington last year, media personality Glenn Beck is planning to hold a Restoring Courage rally in Jerusalem. MSNBC's Rachel Maddow was not pleased. Maddow's beef apparently stems from the belief that Beck's presence in the Middle East will somehow upset the carefully crafted maneuvers that President Barack Obama has made to bring peace to that troubled region. According to the Raw replay, she was pretty adamant. Quoting Rachel Maddow, "What American export could be less helpful to the Middle East than Glenn Beck? Whatever your own politics around Israel and the Palestinians, everybody can agree that this moment in the Middle East is even more delicate than usual. It's time for a deliberate, calm, light touch." The story continues. One wonders what Maddow thinks that Beck may do in Israel. Bring about Armageddon? It's unlikely. Indeed, this is what he intends to do in his own words, and this is where the plot thickens. Listen to what Glenn Beck wants to do. "Last summer, we set out to restore honor in Washington, D.C., Glenn Beck said. This summer, it's time to restore courage. Taking a stand is not always easy. But now more than ever, it is imperative that we live with conviction to do the right thing. Glenn Beck says, it's time for us to courageously stand with Israel. I invite you to join me in Israel this summer to stand together and to show the world what living a life of faith and honor really means. I invite you to join me in my quest to restore courage." Well, ladies and gentlemen, I think you've already heard enough. Glenn Beck pretends to tell us that it takes courage to stand with Israel, which is laughable. It takes courage, Glenn, to objectively criticize Israel, but you're just doing what you get paid to do, so I understand your position. As for Rachel Maddow, I said that she's probably just afraid that there might be some heterosexuals in the crowd, or maybe she's just still mad at me. Does everyone remember the big incident on her radio? Excuse me, I'm radio, she's television. On her television program last year, she had a big segment that she was teasing for an entire hour before she finally got into it. She took me to task on the Rachel Maddow show on MSNBC last year and didn't even have the dignity to accept my invitation to debate. You can watch the video there at my website. I've reposted it this week in light of this story. Starts to get really good about 3 minutes in when she starts to gripe about the political cesspool. Check it out. ThePoliticalCesspool.org. Glenn Beck and Rachel Maddow are at it again. And since we're having so much fun, and since I was having so much fun reliving her attack on me last year, I went ahead and included a picture of Mr. and Mrs. Rachel Maddow. Of course, Rachel Maddow is a militant, radical, feminist lesbian. And got a picture of her and her husband, who is a, yeah, looks about a 300-pound blonde woman. And, you know, and you look at this picture, and there was this big story about it, how they're this perfect little family, you know, city rats living in the country, and they're doing dishes in this picture, and you got Rachel Maddow with her manly haircut, and you've got her husband or wife or whatever role she plays in this relationship, you know, washing the dishes, and she's about a, you know, she's about 400 pounds. But you look at this picture, and how are people supposed to take Maddow seriously? My only problem in looking at this picture, my only concern is determining who's the bigger joke, Rachel Maddow or Glenn Beck. And after you read the story and watch the video and look at the picture, you're going to ask yourself the same thing. Who is the bigger joke? Well, if you want to support a media entity that fights against the kind of message that you're going to be getting from the likes of Glenn Beck and Rachel Maddow, then please consider supporting the Political Cesspool Radio Program. We're a listener-supported broadcast entity, and you can contribute to our work online at thepoliticalcesspool.org. We have gotten a lot of publicity over the years, that's for sure, because we are a one-of-a-kind voice. We're very unique in our positions and our courage to express those convictions in a very clear, concise, and articulate, professional way. And as I mentioned, we have gotten more press and publicity, television, radio, newspapers, magazines, than I can remember after all these years. But we got another little plug this week. Jerome Corsi, the number one best-selling author, New York Times number one best-selling author, for a couple of books in the past. He's just written a new book entitled Where's the Birth Certificate? It's a book about Barack Obama. It, too, is a number one hit. And in it, he favorably acknowledges me and the Political Cesspool for our contributions to the book and some facilitation we did for him while he was writing it. And you got to keep in mind that Jerome Corsi has been on this show a couple of times in the past as a guest. Anyway, after the media caught wind that he was consorting with us, they once again started to attack him. And once again, as he has done in the past, he cut tail and run. And it just begs the question, when are white men going to get over the irrational fear of being called a racist by left-wing kooks? It is, after all, just a word. Sticks and stones, as they say. Anyway, it looks as though Jerome Corsi, sadly, is still allowing the word to cause him some undue grief. I told you about the new book that was being released. I told you that he was kind enough to acknowledge me in the book. Well, it looks like some radical liberal websites weren't too happy with Jerry for dealing with me, and instead of telling them no comment or simply not responding to them at all, like I usually do, he gave them exactly what they wanted, and he sacrificed me, yours truly, as a burnt offering. And I've got the thing there. You can read it for yourself. I put up a little post entitled Toughen Up Jerome Corsi. It's at thepoliticalcesspool.org. But, you know, this guy, you know, he asks for my help. He comes on the show. Every time he's been on the show, he came as a result of him asking me to let him on. And we worked behind the scenes a little bit last year when he was writing this book, which is right now a number one bestseller in this country. He was even kind enough to mention me in the book. And then when the media comes out, he acts as though, you know, I didn't help him, I didn't do this, he doesn't really like us, so on and so forth. You can read it all. It's very sad to see men just fall on their swords so quickly and throw their friends under a bus over a word. And first of all, you know, I got to say, if Jerome Corsi now wants to downplay the help that I gave him, that's cool. I know he gets scared of being called a name, but I'm doing him a huge favor by plugging his book on this radio show and giving him the extra publicity, and I'm glad to do it. I want to go on the record and say that I don't hold any hard feelings, and I hope that his book does well. It tackles an important subject. But what needs to be accomplished with this situation is turning Jerome Corsi's fear of being called a name into a teachable moment. And as I write, we as white men have got to become masters of our own discourse, Jerome, and not allow the left to imprison us with character assassination and baseless name-calling. You know, he can go after the president of the United States with his book, but he's afraid if some no-name, unknown left-wing writer for a website calls him a racist. Well, there's something backwards about that. I've said it before, the horrible defamations that we must endure pale in comparison to the sacrifices of blood and bone that our ancestors gave in order to carve this nation from a wilderness. In the end, that which we suffer isn't so bad. I've even come to enjoy it. Politics is dirty, so you might as well acquire the taste. That's life in the political cesspool. Besides, Jerome Corsi needs to understand that the modern-day definition of racist doesn't mean what he thinks it means. I've included in my post at the website a handy liberal-to-English dictionary. A racist is simply a white person. There, that should help you, Jerome. The point is, they were going to call you a racist whether or not we had worked together or not. And once you understand that, all this other stuff's going to make more sense to you, and you won't get so flustered the next time. All that being said, you're going to be fine. Develop a little bit thicker skin. You need it in this business, and understand that the other side doesn't play by the rules. And there's no such thing as bad publicity. Check it out at thepoliticalcesspool.org. I got to take a break, third hour and final hour coming up right after this.